Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dyslexia Life Hacks Show. I'm your host, Matthew Head, and in this episode, I'm talking to Usha Patel. She is the founder of Vive Practice London. She is a neurocognitive therapist that provides motor sensory and cognitive therapies to children and adults. Usha left her career as an architect to retrain in neurocognitive therapy, and she uses these skills to find the root causes of people's learning difficulties. As always, I'll put links to Revive Practice London and other things we talk about in the show notes, which will be available at dyslexialifehacks.com/podcast. Welcome to the show, Usha.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
No problem at all. Where I wanted to kick our conversation off today is the sort of day that you realised that your career in architecture needed to end and taking up a career in learning development. What was the spark behind that?
Well, it's quite dramatic, really.
Okay.
When I think about it, it was in 2004. I was heavily pregnant with my daughter,
mm-hmm.
and it was Boxing Day, and there was a tsunami. And I worked for an American company, and we had to actually go in to work on Boxing Day because they have very short Christmas breaks. So I was one of the people that had to go into work, and I was like oblivious to what had happened completely. And my colleague came in and he said to me, have you seen the news, Usha? And I'm like, I don't want to hear the news. I just want to know about the donuts that you bought. You promised me donuts. That was all I was interested in because I was eating for like England, really. So he's like, he puts his sort of donuts or bagels down and he says to me, you really need to watch the news. I'm like, what is going on? So we sort of, he sits next to me, he puts the BBC News on, and there's this like news of thousands and thousands of lives lost in the tsunami. And I'm just like crying. I'm like, my goodness me, this is awful. You know, this is just so sad because Christmas being a happy time and then to be abruptly sort of faced with such news, and we'd never seen anything like it. So I was like, all of these things going on and on in my head, thinking, you know, what's going to happen? What if I go to Thailand? Will this happen to me? And at that time, you know, pregnancy is a really strange time because you just are so confused in your head a lot of the time. And it just dawned on me that I just felt a complete sort of phony almost, because I was typing this email to my sister and I couldn't spell the word tsunami. I didn't know how to spell it.
Yeah. It's one of the tricky ones, though.
Yeah. And I was trying to sort of write this email, just say to her, you know, this is awful, it's happened. And I couldn't spell that word. And I just kept thinking to myself, you know what? What sort of a parent am I going to be? I can't spell. And I'm just thinking of all of these things. And it really dawned on me that I chose architecture because I hated spelling. I absolutely hated spelling. I wanted to run away from the written world. I just wanted to be in a world where I could understand and cope better. And spelling just wasn't my thing. So that's when I realized that something in me had to change.
Yeah, okay.
You know, to be a parent, I needed to meet my demons. So that was a turning point, really. It really made me think about all of the things that I was trying to run away from and why and how they would affect this unborn child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Like architecture, creative thing. You do that because you're sort of getting away from the spelling and stuff. I'm like, I love engineering, but one of the things about engineering is being able to not have to rely on the written word as heavily as say other professions, but that is not my primary reason for being there. So obviously you then realize that actually you bring a child into the world. I mean, architecture is quite a prestigious profession, really. But you felt the need to maybe face your demons. How did you start looking into that? How did you think, well, yeah, what do I need to do first?
Well, I really needed to understand about my problems with spelling I also needed to understand child development. So the two sort of came together.
Yeah.
And I used to read a lot, and I wanted to understand everything about spelling problems and how you can overcome them. So in my journey, I found something called the Infinity Walk.
Okay.
And the Infinity Walk is designed by Dr. Deborah Sunbeck. And it's a physical activity. And what I learned was reading isn't just a brain thing. It's an eye thing. It's an ear thing. It's a physical thing.
Yeah.
And that was just a big eye opener for me, really, because I just kept thinking, you know, there's something wrong with my brain.
Mm.
And then I realized, no, actually, it could be something wrong with my eyes or how I listen and process things. So, yeah, I just was really blown away with that idea. And I think a lot of parents who discover their child has got, you know, some sort of neurodivergence think about the brain as the first and foremost thing. But in essence, there are lots of physiological issues that happen because issues that are at play which stop them from accessing how to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's sort of more holistic thinking. But what exactly is an infinity walk for people who don't understand what it is?
Infinity walk is done indoors. We're coming down outdoors. But essentially what you're doing is you are walking in the figure of eight.
Yes. Okay.
And as you walk, align to the center of where the eight crosses, the two, you know, the intersection of the eight. Parallel to that point is a person or a television or something that the walker has to look at. So whilst they are walking, they are looking at that person or at the TV the entire time. Because if you, and all they have to do is move their head from side to side so that they can focus on that stimulus, be it a television or a person or, you know, whatever, or even looking out of a window. And doing that, what's happening is that at one half of the eight, you have your right side facing the stimulus. And then on the other side, you're doing the other side, the left side. And that helps with moving your eyes right across to the outer edges. As you look at the TV or the person, you have to move your eyes all the way across. And this is all a motor activity. It's a physical activity. But if you don't have the muscles in your eyes to actually move your eyes across and you can only move them to the middle, then you're not going to feel comfortable in moving your eyes across the printed page.
Oh, I see. That's the connection, right?
Yes. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to integrate a sense of bilateral hearing, because one time you're looking at it, you're facing your right ear, the next time you're facing your left ear. And so visually and auditorily and physically, you are having to move your body so that you can observe and take in what you're looking at. Now, if, for example, your right eye doesn't move as far when you're looking at the stimulus because you're on the left side, then you're going to have to compensate. And as you compensate, I'm learning about where the physical problems are occurring and how they interface with how that child processes information.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So you're doing it as a diagnostics tool, and you obviously started with yourself to begin with.
Absolutely. And, but, you know, my journey was a sort of I was doing lots of different things. I was learning about, you know, how people actually learn to spell. And for that, I did a lot of you know, research into phonics and how phonics are learnt and taught. And at my time at school, I wasn't taught phonics and I wasn't actually diagnosed with dyslexia.
Okay.
I haven't been diagnosed with it. But what I do, and this is where it's very interesting, is that I scan instead of left to right, I scan from right to left. That's my scanning preference.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, of course, that makes reading tricky.
Yeah, but I learned how to scan the correct way, but I just didn't realize until I did that course all of those years that when I was reading, I would have to reread because I was scanning incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and this is what I learned, that a lot of children are writing letters in reverse because they are scanning incorrectly and they are writing what they scan. So if they're writing a letter D, that because they're scanning it the other way, they end up writing letter B.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah.
So it's quite a complex thing. And the more I delved into it, the more there was to learn about. But very, very interesting. And I realized it's not just about the brain. It's about the whole body and how the body works physically to take in that information with ease.
Okay. So let's go back to, you said that you weren't diagnosed with dyslexia, but obviously you're aware that you might have some neurodiversity going on. Now, at what point in time did you think, hang on, there's something different with the way I learn compared to everybody else? And when did you realize you start having problems, particularly you mentioning your spelling and English skills?
Well, I got through school. I got 6 GCSEs.
Oh, yeah.
Or O levels, or whatever you call them. And then I did A levels. I got through them as well.
Okay, yeah.
But I think it really came to play when I started working, because I did my A levels and then I went to work and I would have to type address labels, and one of the names I would have to type was Brian, but I would always type it Brain.
Yes, that's a classic. Yeah,
because I would get those wrong way around.
Yeah,
and
dear Brain.
Yeah, dear Brain. So my employer said to me, you know what? There is something going on here. Now, yeah. Because if you've done a level of academics and you've passed everything,
you feel
that actually, you know, you're in the clear. You don't have, you know, because that's evidence, right?
Yeah, you've made the cut, so to speak. Yeah.
Exactly. So it wasn't really a sort of thing that I thought about until that time. And then I realized, well, maybe that's why I hate spelling because I don't understand how spellings work. And it was, I studied architecture as a mature student.
Okay.
So, you know, I knew at that point I wanted to do something that didn't involve lots of spelling.
Yes. Because, but did you have another interest in architecture apart from, so we say, the avoidance of spelling?
Well, yes, of course I did. I mean, I worked in the architectural field when I left school.
Okay, yeah.
So that was, you know, one of my first jobs. I worked in the architectural field, working with lighting designers, furniture designers, and I just absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was just where I wanted to be in that whole environment, which was, you know, it was just a match made in heaven, really. And I really understood how spaces were made, how spaces were created implicitly. I could really relate to that. And my sort of problem solving brain could really visualize how spaces should be. But then also I'm a people person as well. So my career in clinical planning, hospital design, you know, I really had to understand the psychology of how spaces are created for that particular use. because I specialize in interior architecture.
Okay. Hey, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I had to really understand. So I would talk to loads of people about different spaces to understand the psychology of how a particular type of room in a hospital is used, as well as the practical aspects as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, you mentioned there quite a few dyslexic strengths with the visualization and the 3D thinking and all that stuff. Of course, architecture and being an architect is another profession that pulls quite a lot of them out and uses them to great strengths as well.
Absolutely. But I think that essentially, you know, it's problem solving.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's problem solving. So I think that that is the sort of common thread that is in my new career. Well, it's not so new, but I've been doing it for some time now. But yeah. So yeah, it's definitely problem solving is what, you know, is the common theme there.
Yes. Yes. So did you at the time, you were saying your boss said there might be some sort of neurodiversity going on. Did you at the time think, I'll go do something about this? Or did you take any testing up? Did it just sort of turn you on to the idea and you sort of did a bit of, should we say, self-help?
No, I just sort of dismissed it. I really just...
Oh, okay.
I just kept thinking to myself, yeah, whatever. No, because I knew I didn't like spelling.
Yeah.
I was capable of passing exams. I was capable of learning.
Of course, yeah.
So I just thought to myself, well, it's just a quirk. and really, I think that it's because, you know, children of that time weren't taught synthetic phonics as they are now.
Yes, it was different.
And so I learned to read using whole word recognition. And this is what I drilled it down to. I learned to read with whole word recognition. Now, if you learn to read with whole word recognition and you are reading from right to left, when you're reading something like spot, you could read it as stop because the same letters feature in that spelling and you could equally write it incorrectly as well.
Yeah, 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 of course, yes, yeah.
You're not actually thinking about the individual letters within the configuration of that spelling. So when my boss said that to me, I just sort of like thought, you know what, whatever, you know, because it wasn't a barrier. It was just a quirk. I just thought of it as a quirk.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's interesting how different people would sort of like stop in their tracks and I don't know, go down that diagnostic route. But it didn't occur to me. I just thought I was just quirky and I'm going to have to live with it.
I see. Well, and of course, then it took really until the events of the tsunami and being pregnant at the same time to kind of flip a switch about the quirk and be like, hang on, maybe I should do something here.
Absolutely. It was just that moment where I was just like struggling to type words and I just realized how inadequate I was. And it just sort of dawned on me that this is actually a problem, you know?
Yes. What did that look like then after that? At some point, you start retraining neurocognitive therapy. Now, out of all the sort of options that were available to you, what sort of led you to neurocognitive therapy versus some of the other things? Because you know, quite a lot of choice out there in terms of helping people with neurodiversity.
Well, I thought the idea that this is a physical problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are physiological issues at play was a totally different way of looking at it. No, if your eyes don't move in the right way, it has nothing to do with whether you need glasses or not. It's actually to do with the agility of the muscles in your eyes. Equally, they might not move vertically nicely, in which case you would have problems doing column addition.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You know, or maybe they don't move diagonally nicely. So therefore, when you're moving from your book to copy from the board and you've got to move your eyes up, you can't do it. You have to move your head up. It just made me realize that, you know, it's not everything. It's not about the brain. It's about the body as well. The body is informing. It's taking information and informing how the information that's being assimilated. And that then is part of how that person learns or how they don't learn. You know, it's quite interesting. And I just found that really, really fascinating. And I just thought, you know, I'm a very practical person. Yeah. And I liked that practical approach because it was very direct. You could see if a child was able to draw a circle, which is a very straightforward thing. And how they draw it, do they draw it clockwise by default or anti-clockwise? Now, I am left-handed.
Okay.
So for me, I would draw it anti-clockwise. Now, if you are learning to write, you really need to learn to write and draw circles clockwise because that's how cursive letters are formed, clockwise.
Yes. Yeah, of course, yeah.
So all of these different things, physical things, made perfect sense to me. And they sort of like made me think, you know what? Maybe that is why I couldn't form my letters so quickly because I was trying to write differently to everybody else.
Of course, yeah. If you're building the neural connections to draw a circle anti-clockwise, which makes sense if you're left-handed, your hand's not smudging the circle as you spin it, then you've got to go the opposite way when you start writing. And you have to go that way when you start writing because that's how cursive letters work. There's no kind of, left-handed version of cursive writing, is there? Of course, you start thinking along them lines and... what point do you completely give up on the architecture career and go full-time into helping?
Well, I think that when I was having my year of maternity leave,
yes,
I decided to write off to sub schools.
Oh, yeah.
And to work on a voluntary basis, testing some of the ideas that I had. And I sort of discovered that I understood the children really well. I understood their problems. And I worked with about 3 children. And I had to deal with things like helping them with phonological understanding. And I didn't learn it in 1 year. I was learning it as I was teaching as well. And I used a fantastic dyslexia resource called Alpha to Omega, by Dyslexia Action, and it's called Alpha to Omega, their A to Z of reading, writing, and spelling. So that was what I used to teach myself.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then I started using it with children because this is, in essence, how is synthetic phonics.
Oh.
You know, that's how I learned. So I then started to use that in the context of what I did. And, you know, I could really sort of, I could really be creative, let's say, in the way in which I presented the information. And the children, just the ones I worked with, really took to it. In the meantime, you know, the architectural profession wasn't very keen on flexible working hours.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, this is some time ago. I think things have changed. And so, you know, I knew that it was going to be a real challenge for me to return back with a baby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I sort of thought to myself, what do I want to do? Do I want to teach my baby how to not have the sort of problems I had? Or do I want to, you know, keep going on in this profession where I wasn't going to see her very often? I'd be doing long hours and it was going to be sort of very challenging to meet both jobs, as it were, to be being a parent and working in a challenging job, which was very responsible. So it's sort of like there was a decision which sort of came to its own conclusion.
Yes.
Because I didn't want the idea of leaving my daughter in childcare for long hours. So I just decided that I would like to do that, you know, as a sort of a job between looking after her. So that's how it all came about, really.
Okay. So if I came to your practice as a new patient. Now, obviously, I don't expect you to give away all the secrets on this podcast, but what would these sort of initial kind of sessions and stuff look like? How does your methodology work? I'm trying to kind of get an understanding and get a feel for it.
Well, I would do like a detailed... I mostly work with children, Matthew. I don't work with a lot of adults. I do a lot of... I do specialise in working memory, where I work with all age groups. But generally speaking, the children that come to me, I will ask the parent to give me a list of in you know, normal language of where they see their child struggling.
Yeah.
So I would be armed with a list of information about that child, and I would see things like is not listening, making spelling mistakes, takes a long time over homework, hates having to do his reading of an evening. And I just have a list of all of these different things. And I would get to work in working with them in a very playful way, because when you're walking in the figure of eight, you're actually not sitting down at a desk. So once children know that they're not going to be sitting at a desk, they're already my friend. You know, they already are on side. And what I'm doing is, as they're walking, we're playing different games, and I'm learning about how they understand sequencing, how they understand the letters of the alphabet, whether they know the letters of the alphabet, where the glitches are. So if they get to the letter C and they think it's an S, well, I'm looking out for markers, really. So I learn about the child in a very playful way.
Okay.
And how they understand academics, because essentially the parents coming to me are looking for educational help. And a lot of them are not looking to seek a diagnosis.
Okay.
They want to just get the help for the not listening, not wanting to read. They just want the help. They don't necessarily want to have a diagnosis for their child, and that all their child might be too young for a diagnosis. As they walk and we play, I do throwing, catching exercises as well, and I'm assessing how they are able to do all of these things: walking, looking, listening, talking. It's being layered. The activity is being layered with multiple challenges to see and stretch that whole range of cognitive abilities, how they think. And we do all sorts of different things. But one of the important things I do is I work with them in a very playful way to understand how they learn. That's what I want to do. So whilst I'm armed with this list of problems, the parent sees, I am also feeding into that list and seeing that they actually have auditory processing problems as well, because they might have not been able to read a word correctly or mispronounce a word because they perceived a letter to be different as they heard it. So I'm looking for all of the things which make up that individual and how they learn. And at the same time, it's a separate exercise, I'm teaching them how to sequence, because sequencing plays a big part in reading and maths. And if they can't sequence, then they're going to have a real tough time in when they are able to decode to actually work sequentially through the phonics part of blending the letters together to create words. So I'm looking at, you know, how they sequence, and we do that by doing things like origami, talking about their day. So I'm learning about the child through play, essentially, and the child will always feel good because I stop when it gets really difficult, and I just change tack, and they always feel they can do it.
Okay, yeah.
But often children, they don't know, the ones that are coming to me, they wouldn't, you know, they might be age 8 and they don't know the months of the year in order. Or they might be older and they're not able to understand how to read an analog clock or how to read a large number.
Yeah, yeah.
And it boils down to a lot of things. Are they looking at the information right to left? Are they able to sequence that information into the chunks that it's supposed to in the right direction? So there's loads of different things that play, and I'm looking for clues as to what it is that they're struggling with and how I can help them overcome it. And I have done a lot of different training. I've trained in reflex integration, and that reflex integration is a very relatively new area of neurocognitive therapy for most people. And it's really looking at how a child is predisposed and their foundational physical skills. So if the child had trauma at birth, or if they were cesarean, or their birth experience, how can I say this? It will be a situation which then affects them quite a lot developmentally. So, for example, a premature baby who's in NICU,
yep.
They will be subjected to bright lights because that baby has to be monitored.
Yeah, of course.
And monitoring the baby with bright lights means the baby is not able to develop natural circadian rhythms.
Oh yes. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, yeah.
And so that whole experience is going to, in effect, be with them and affect their development. This is not to say they can't develop circadian rhythms, but they are predisposed to not having that at the start. And reflex integration is actually creating the ability to have foundational movements so that foundational movements which are required from when they are from a non-gravitational environment to a gravitational environment, and how they are physically adapting themselves for this change. Because we need a different set of survival instincts in a non-gravitational environment to what we need in a gravitational environment. So if they were somehow interrupted, or they weren't allowed to happen naturally, or there was just a problem, those things have to be sorted out by reflex integration. And this is our movement-based exercises, again, very practical, where that child is able to develop the missing developmental links to help them to the next stage. And essentially what I'm doing in my work is I am going back to wherever the developmental gaps are for that child, bridging the gaps and moving forward. And I do that at a physical level with this work. And then I also do it at a cognitive level as well, in terms of things like working memory and auditory processing as well.
Okay. So it's quite a lot. It sounds really holistic as well. So you're using quite a lot of tools and using the diagnostics you already mentioned to work out what each child needs. Now, how do you sort of tie it all together? How do you link the mind and the physical actions? You're saying about the eyes moving and not moving in an optimal direction or moving in the right way, but the brain sort of drives the eyes. So let's take that as an example. Somebody reads right to left rather than left to right. Now, what would you do to kind of correct that and get them breathing smoothly?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So when we are scanning and tracking children, you know, it might be discovered that they're tracking incorrectly. So yeah. I would say, okay, as a piece of instruction, we should have a bookmark, okay? And yeah. Let's make it a red bookmark. And let's put that red bookmark on the left-hand side of the page. So the child has to track from the red bookmark.
Yeah.
Has to start at the red bookmark. And so they're moving from, they know then that they have to start on the left. And that simple tool, for example, can help them track correctly when they're reading. But then at the same time, it's a bigger issue because, you know, they might not be able to make a range of movements. So I would get them to do different shapes on a whiteboard. So starting with a circle, do they understand the difference between drawing a circle in one direction and the other direction? And if they don't, I give them the tools to do that. But at the same time, if they're drawing a circle which is 40 centimeters in diameter, they have to really move their eyes all the way so that they can see as they trace or draw.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these are the sort of activities I do, also making sure that they're able to do a range of sort of movements with their eyes so that I know that they are able to make that, they can transfer that into other activities, be it column addition or scanning, you know, when they're reading. And also I suggest things like using digital books, because if you're using a digital book compared to a printed book, if you have, you can make an adjustment of the size of the font.
Yes.
It is a lot easier on the eyes because there are fewer words on each line.
Yeah.
And it just is a lot easier. So there are lots of tools that I use to help that individual.
Okay. And how can you tell that the... A, you're using the right tool out of the toolbox, and B, that it's having the effect you expect. How you kind of, because maybe you, the eyes start to read from left to right, but actually there's more going on. So you've got to kind of, I guess, working out the nuances here. Have we sorted the eyes out, but actually there's something else built on top of it. It's kind of this co-occurrence going on.
Absolutely. It's everything is happening all at once, because let's just say one of the problems is the child is not able to copy.
Yes.
Okay. Not able to copy well. So the issue is not just one thing, it's how they are seated, whether their core is strong or upright. And if it's not, would it help if there was a box under their feet where they can push down on the box with their feet and push themselves up so that their head would be in the right place? So that they can actually then be able to, they wouldn't be drooping down. So there are a number of different things that I employ to help them be physically and from a sort of to be at their optimum. And essentially, you know, it's a case of seeing how they behave in that activity, understanding how that behavior is affecting that activity, and then making corrections, adaptations, and also bridging the developmental gaps as well.
Okay, so there's really, really a lot to it. And how do you feel it differs from other methods? Because people in this podcast have listened to quite a few people come on and do various different methods. So how do you feel yours, sort of, what's your unique selling point, so to speak?
Well, I think that in essence, I really enjoy what I do, and I'm learning new skills and new things all the time. And my work essentially can be at any point. So I could be working with an adult who is has got a poor working memory.
Mm.
And so I would say that I am able to understand that adult and their poor working memory and the difficulty it brings in their professional life.
Yes. Yeah.
And tools to help them bridge that gap. Equally, as a young child who's not been diagnosed with anything, who's got a multitude of different problems. So I'm not necessarily trying to put a label on that person. I'm trying to understand what the nature of the problem is and dealing with that problem, rather than putting a label on that individual and saying, look, I think all of these different things mean that you have got this problem and this neurodivergent condition. In essence, if I am looking at the individual problems, because you have concurrent different problems existing in one individual,
yeah,
I'm looking at the problems and not the diagnosis. So that's what makes me different. What are the problems? How do they hinder progress for whatever needs to be done, and what is needed to help that particular problem?
Okay. Interesting. So every guest that comes on the podcast gets three rapid fire questions from me throughout the show out. Now, they don't need quick answers from you, but they are quick questions from me. So let's dive into question number one. What prejudice have you had about dyslexia that's been proven wrong?
I think that I don't really look at dyslexia in that way, but I look at it as a number of different problems. But I mean, to answer your question, I think that children learn differently, individuals learn differently, and it's giving them access to the joy of learning rather than focusing on that diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's giving them access to the joy of learning however they learn, and giving them that freedom, and enjoying the process rather than focusing on their diagnosis. And it might be that a child can't read but loves story. They love stories. So maybe that individual would like to learn by listening to stories. So I want to separate the learning from the process of learning.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, and giving a child something like a book that they can write in, and not having someone judge what they write. It's their stories they can write. So allowing them to have the joy of that activity without that constant judgment of whether their spellings are wrong or whether their handwriting is bad, or just giving them that freedom to encourage them to enjoy the love of learning, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think a lot of children who get diagnosed with dyslexia, all of a sudden they put labels to themselves.
Yeah.
And it stops them from actually enjoying the stuff they could enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think I'm guilty of that one, definitely. Okay, then rapid fire question number two. If an alien landed and you had described dyslexia to them, how would you do it?
Well, I think dyslexia is another way to say another word for creative thinkers. And these creative thinkers are valued in art and science and business. And so that's how I would describe it, really, creative thinkers. that are appreciated for all of their different talents.
Yes, very good description. Okay, and the final question is rapid fire set. And seeing as this is the Dyslexia Life Hacks show, what is your favourite dyslexia life hack?
I think you shouldn't let a diagnosis define who you are. It's not necessarily the case. And working to your strengths and having compassion, just seeing what your strengths are really and working to them can really free up a lot of self-judgment and allow you to prosper.
Yes, most definitely. Okay, well, before we sign off, where can people find you? And is there anything else you'd like to add?
People can find me at Revive Practice London. And I think that I'd like to add that people listening to this show should really focus and think about all of those individual elements which make up their diagnosis rather than the word itself. And look for within those particular areas rather than feel overwhelmed by this word dyslexia.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, that leads me to thank you, Usha, for taking the time to come on the show today. It's been really interesting talking to you.
No, you're very welcome. It's been a real joy. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank everybody else for taking the time to listen, and I'll speak to you in the next episode. Goodbye for now.